dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The men we turn to frequently for sense of what's happening in that battle space, intelligence and otherwise, is a, well, naval intelligence officer in a previous incarnation, also former White House staffer under Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and most recently an assistant secretary of state with responsibility for narcotics and law enforcement affairs in the George W. Bush administration. He is, of course, Robert Charles. You frequently see him at Fox. You read his writings at foxnews.com and amac.com and elsewhere. He's a very welcome guest here. Good to have you back, Robert. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thank you, Frank.
There's a lot going on in this war for the free world at the moment, Robert, and I thought maybe I'd just quickly get an update from you about the border situation. I was struck, even national public radio today acknowledged that it's generally conceded at the moment that there is, in fact, a crisis along our southern border. What do you make of this insight, first of all, and that seeming, finally, seeming consensus?
So, Frank, you're right about it. As Winston Churchill said, you can step on it, you can kick it, you can crush it, and the truth is always still there. I think what we're witnessing on the border is a crisis. The president said it from the beginning, and even the mainstream media is beginning to recognize you can't look away from it forever. We're looking at roughly 100,000 illegal entrants per month, now month over month. And it's an enormous strain on everything from, our law enforcement resources at the local, state, and federal level, up to and including, of course, their sort of instant on into entitlements. So, and it's not going to get better anytime soon, because you've got the Central American countries really falling apart. You've got Venezuela in free fall. Venezuela, I was talking to some folks at state, they've got more than 3.5 million refugees leaving that country, some of them coming up through the land, degree of stability, many of them settling in Colombia. But the border is going to be a national security issue for the indefinite future. And I think the only way, the next step the media has to take is to say, they'll never say the president was right, but to say, yes, deterrence and a genuine capacity to stop the inflow is required.
Well, I hope so. It certainly seems obvious to most of us, and yet that tractor beam sort of magnet is still operating. They are still coming. There are still large areas of the border that are insecure. In fact, it's often said that the folks you used to work so hard against in office are in control of both sides of the border, namely the drug cartels. And it seems as though you say, We're going to see this getting worse for quite some time. And let me just ask you to put this in context, Robert, because what has happened in Europe with very profound effects has been the infusion of some millions of immigrants from other parts of the world. And while our country is larger than some of the countries in which they arrived, it's still, when you're talking about the numbers that are now in play here, it is a very considerable problem for both, the economy, for public health and public safety and national security, is it not?
Well, it is. And I think many Americans may not know, but we have a set number of entrants that are permitted from different regions and different countries of the world legally every year. And we set that with intent because there's only so much assimilation no matter where you place people, that can occur reasonably in a year. And there are certain countries that people, and then above and beyond country by country levels, you have individual claims for asylum, which are not based on whether your country is poor or destitute or impoverished in public corruption ways or in other ways. It's based on your individual case. So those are above and beyond. But we cannot realistically continue to absorb 100,000 illegal entrants every year. And you think about it, it also undermines all of those who are doing the right thing and trying to come in legally and following the law. They should always be at the front of the queue. So we're a country that loves legal immigration, but we do not and cannot tolerate indefinite, as the Europeans cannot, indefinite illegal immigration, where borders mean nothing, sovereignty means nothing, and citizenship means nothing.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, sovereignty means nothing, which is the end of our republic. Let me ask you, too, quickly, I'm going to speak shortly with Daniel Greenfield about this, but I'd like to get your thoughts as well, Robert, given your expertise and service to our country and senior positions. When you see what's happening at the border between Gaza and Israel and the enormous firepower that is being unleashed against the Israelis and their rather decisive retaliation, would you put this at the feet of Iran, or is this an entirely home-brewed operation as far as Hamas is concerned?
Well, I don't know that anything Hamas does can be separated from what Iran promotes. You know, Iran has created new pressure for us in the Gulf. I'm imagining behind the scenes what's happening is we have now said that the waivers to a number of countries. We gave waivers to seven countries to allow them to continue to buy Iranian oil for a very short period of time. We've now essentially said those waivers are coming to an end, and that includes Turkey and India and China and several other countries that are resistant to that, but I think will eventually fall into line behind that set of sanctions. The Iranian economy is, as it should be, feeling the impact of that, but I'm imagining that these things are all related. Iran is saber rattling in the Gulf. Potentially, I think, might try to stop Saudi oil shipments or something like that. The United States has just decided, I think yesterday, to send another aircraft carrier battle group, the Abraham Lincoln, to the Gulf to make crystal clear that that will not be an impeded waterway. And at the same time, Iran has been putting new pressure, I think, both in Syria and through Hamas on Israel. You know, the thing that I think Iran needs to understand is there are limits to what I think both Israel and the United States will tolerate in terms of aberrant, both terrorist and essentially surrogate war-making activity. And at a certain point in time, there will be decisive action taken against them. And I think, their leaders have no legitimacy. The people, the vast majority of the population is young. They'd like iPhones, not more Ayatollahs. And I think they are, there's a moment here in Iran where, as a people, they are seeing that their government is doing things with their money and with their name that really, I think, undermines overall support for anybody in there.
We have to leave it at that. Thank you so much. Robert Charles, come back to us again very soon, if you will.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by a man we've not talked with in frightfully long, and that's something I regret. His name is Daniel Greenfield. He is one of the smartest guys I've ever encountered, and his insights into so many of the public policy challenges of our time are really extraordinary and the kind of thing that I treasure being able to share with our audience. So, Daniel, it's good to have you back, and forgive me for not having been darkening your door more frequently. Daniel, of course, is a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He blogs as Sultan Knesh, and is often featured in Front Page magazine and Israel National News. It's always good to talk with you. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. It's an honor and a privilege.
Daniel, I'm particularly interested in picking up on a theme that we began a moment ago with our friend Robert Charles about developments in the Middle East. There is, of course, a world of hurt out there. He talked a bit about the attacks from Hamas into Israel and Israel's justified response to them, and the possibility that this may have something to do with Iran lashing out. The dangers Iran poses more generally to the Strait of Hormuz and the need for an American carrier battle group to head there to try to protect our interests. You've written about another place that Iran has been much in evidence lately, namely Syria. Give us sort of a 30,000-foot level overview of how you see things in the Middle East at the moment, and then we'll drill down on some of these specific topics.
Certainly. Hamas, for all the media attention that it gets, is the tail. The question is locating the dog whom the tail belongs to. Iran, as you've mentioned, as Robert apparently mentioned, certainly is one of the dogs. Iran provides weapons. It provides some of the financing for Hamas. Qatar, because of its connection to the Muslim Brotherhood, is a major sponsor of Hamas also. So when Hamas escalates, when it actually breaks out into violence, and this often does happen in the summer months, the summer months tend to be violent times in the Middle East. That is generally linked to either Iran or Hamas or Iran or Qatar or the global ambitions of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is also a factor. Now, one point is that the Trump administration has signaled that it's actually moving to potentially list the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. And as a result, it is possible that the Muslim Brotherhood wanted Hamas to escalate in order to disrupt the Trump administration's foreign policy. Because what these terrorist groups in the region often do, they don't escalate to a final war at this point. What they do is actually escalate the violence and force the United States into a position where they have to negotiate, or force Israel into a position where they have to negotiate. So that may be very well what's going on here.
I'm glad you mentioned this idea of the designation of the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, Daniel Greenfield. Are you in support of that designation? There are those who argue that, it may be a, I call it a Sharia supremacist entity, but it's a group that has eschewed violence, yet terrorism, by definition, in this country at least, involves its use. What are your thoughts on that?
So there are two counter-arguments being made to designating the Muslim Brotherhood. One is that it has non-military aspects to it, which is, again, a completely farcical argument, because nearly every terrorist group is divided into military and political arms. That's not an argument for not designating the political arms as part of a terrorist organization. That's effectively plausible deniability. There's no question that the Muslim Brotherhood operates on both fronts. And for the second argument, it largely involves the whole now discredited idea of democratization that drove the Arab Spring. And that has not only been discredited in the Middle East, where when the Muslim Brotherhood was given the opportunity to win elections, to come to power politically, what it began doing was cracking down on the political opposition and engaging in violence in places like Egypt. It's also been discredited in Turkey, where which was originally going to be the model for Islamic democracy. It was going to show that political Islamist parties could coexist with the rest of the political ecosystem. And Turkey these days is an Islamic tyranny that imprisons tens and thousands of its political opponents. So the idea of Islamic democracy has very decisively failed. It's failed across the Middle East. It's failed in Turkey. There really is no serious reason to think that the approach of having Islamist political parties run for office will produce human rights, will produce civil rights, will produce a peaceful society, that it will actually have multiple political movements coexisting together the way they do in the United States.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And this is a problem, of course, for American foreign policy interests abroad. The mistake that the Obama administration made in what's been called Presidential Study Directive 11, a still classified document, Daniel, but one that I know has been cited as the impetus behind the U.S. government's embrace during the Obama years of the Brotherhood. It's just a catastrophic mistake, but worse in a way is the extent to which it has helped to legitimate and empower and certainly to embolden the Muslim Brotherhood's rather vast network of front organizations and operatives inside this country as well. I'm looking forward to this designation in the hopes that it would bring that to an end. Your thoughts?
I think it is long overdue. The Muslim Brotherhood has made it very clear in the past that its goal, even in this case, to quote Erdogan, who is not the Muslim Brotherhood, but who said that democracy is like a streetcar. When it arrives at your destination, you get off. That's how Muslim Brotherhood, or how any Islamist political movement, will view democracy, will view elections as just another opportunity to impose a tyrannical state of Sharia supremacism on a political electorate, and to do this by any means necessary, including advocating for justice. So the Muslim Brotherhood is very much an enemy organization. It is one that believes in overthrowing the Constitution. It believes in inequality before the law, because a fundamental part of Sharia is that men are not equal to women. It is that non-Muslims are not equal to Muslims, and that any truly just political system is one that is based on Islamic law and that is based on the inequality of non-Muslims to Muslims. And there is absolutely no room within America for such a political system. It is in opposition to everything that Americans believe. It's certainly in opposition to everything we believe around the world. And when we back the Muslim Brotherhood's efforts to impose that system in places like Egypt, we're violating our own values. When we tolerate it at home, we are once again violating our own values.
Yeah, and endangering them, more to the point. Let me ask you, Daniel, you mentioned Turkey several times. I would actually argue that Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a backer of the Muslim Brotherhood, even if he's not a brother himself. A little unclear, but he certainly is an enabler, as you mentioned, is Qatar. What role is Turkey playing at the moment, and Iran in Syria? And you've written recently about the wellspring of the disaster there. Connect those dots for us, if you would.
So there is a loose Islamist coalition currently operating of Iran, of Qatar, of Turkey, and of the non-state actors like the Muslim Brotherhood, in some degrees like Al-Qaeda, that are operating and taking on the United States. They're taking on Saudi Arabia and, the UAE and some of the countries that have decided that having Islamist movements running wild is not in their political interest. That coalition is somewhat loose because they do have different interests, just like Russia and Iran have different interests in Syria. Turkey has a very clear nationalistic interest in Syria because Syria does contain Turkic minorities, just as Iraq does. So Turkey's Islamist regime operates on two levels. One is the nationalistic one. It wants to empower and exploit Turkic minorities in order to expand its, because really Erdogan's original idea is to bring back the Ottoman Empire. And on the other end, you have, of course, the Islamist end of things, which is a coalition with other Islamist political movements, other Islamic state actors, whose goal is to actually expand under the guise of Islamic Sharia law. So on the one hand, they're backing the Brotherhood, as you've mentioned. On the other hand, they're backing Turkic minorities, and they're trying to integrate all these different elements together. And obviously, even though we talk about Islamists having this larger worldview, the restoration of the caliphate and all that sort of thing, they've got personal nationalistic ambitions, territorial ambitions, much as ISIS did. They want to expand their particular sphere, and they want to use Islam to do it.
So we do see Erdogan pursuing a caliphate. Is there any question in your mind on that? And would it have geographic implications for nations beyond Syria? Talk a little bit about Turkey and Israel in this regard.
Erdogan has been quite explicit about pursuing a caliphate. The entire talk of the restoration of the Ottoman Empire, he spent $1 billion on a palace stocked with people in Ottoman costumes. So it's he's been about as clear about it as ISIS has. The implications for Israel are obviously bad. The implications for the region are obviously bad because the Ottoman Empire originally controlled all this territory. And if we're going to bring back the Ottoman Empire, you're doing more than just throwing a costume party in an expensive palace. You actually want to reclaim all these territories. And Erdogan has talked in terms of the Ottoman Empire when he talks about asserting control over what Israel does, over what other territories does. His central argument is that if the Ottoman Empire were still in place, infidels like the Israeli Jews would not be able to assert control over the so-called Palestinians. They would be fighting in Syria. All this conflict would go away. So it's in essence the same argument as ISIS. And it's paradoxical that we don't treat the argument the same way, that we treat it as more legitimate than when ISIS calls for a caliphate, because what is the practical difference between the vision of the Ottoman Empire and the ISIS caliphate? The Ottoman Empire used many of the same brutal Islamic executions as ISIS has. It practiced slavery, including sex slavery, well until recent times. Bringing back the Ottoman Empire would very much be something very similar to the ISIS caliphate.
Yeah, to say nothing of genocide against Christians and others that the Turks have been involved in previous incarnations. Thank you for your time today and for your lips addressing our ears so well. It's always appreciated. I hope you'll do it again soon. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang about developments in Asia, specifically what China's up to, and much more right after this.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's time for our regular visit with Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on Asia, and most especially what Communist China is doing there and elsewhere that should be of grave concern to us. Gordon is, of course, the author of three terrific books: The Coming Collapse of China, The Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. He contributes to The Daily Beast, The National Interest, and other outlets, as well as, of course, Fox News and this program. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank.
Well, I wanted to sort of take stock with you, Gordon. There was some high drama over the weekend when the president announced that he was going to impose 25% tariffs, replacing the 10% ones on some $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. This was obviously done in the run-up to and context of trade negotiations. The Chinese seem to be coming ahead for what they hope, I suppose, will be the end game of those negotiations. Give us a readout on what it all means and what you think is likely to come out of this week's parleys.
The president's tweet on Sunday is significant because it shows the United States is losing patience with China. And it's not only the scheduled tariff increase that you talk about. The president said that he was thinking of putting 25% tariffs on the remaining Chinese imports into the U.S. This is really good news because we should be disengaging our economy from China. This will put pressure on China to come to terms. They have been waffling. We have heard that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has overruled his trade negotiators who have made concessions to the U.S. So these talks were not going anywhere, and it's good that President Trump is losing patience.
Do you think that it's a bluff, or do you think that he is seriously prepared to walk away, as he has said you have to do sometimes in the art of the deal?
Yeah. Well, President Trump walked away from the North Koreans at the second summit with Kim Jong-un in Hanoi at the end of February. So I think that he is prepared to walk away from trade talks with China. We'll find out. But the important point is that we're now using negotiating tactics that we should have been using all along in prior administrations. In prior administrations, we were so solicitous of the Chinese that we were not willing to defend ourselves. And what we have right now is a president who is defending American interests. That's a great advance.
It is a great advance, and one that I think is long overdue. My own feeling about this, Gordon, is that unless and until China ceases its unrestricted warfare against us, which we've been documenting, of course, with your help, among others, in the context of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, that we're basically going to be getting a mug's game if we settle some trade issues, even if the Chinese honor their commitments, which they've not generally done. So we'll be watching this space very closely. Gordon, let me ask you about another space that I think you've been studying as of late, and that is a new study issued recently by the Department of Defense here in the United States about the growing power of China's military, and specifically some of its insights into sort of the comprehensive way the Chinese are pursuing, as I say, this component of their unrestricted warfare strategy. What were your most important takeaways from that report?
I think the most important thing is that the report these days is quite long and detailed. And this is contrast to the happy talk in prior administrations, both Republicans and Democrats. I think it's important that we're starting to come to grips with the comprehensive nature of China's challenge. And I was very happy to see that the report dealt with cyber theft and spying, because this goes to really the American economy. The Chinese are trying to wound our society by stealing intellectual property, and they're doing it to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And this, of course, is relevant to the military power report, because if you don't have an economy, you don't have the money for a military.
And this is evident that our challenge is not only to have money for our military, but to see what we can do to dry up some of the money that the Chinese are investing in theirs, quite clearly. There was an oversight, apparently, deliberate presumably, but perhaps accidental, by the government in not taking note, according to our friend Bill Gertz, of the laser incidents involving Chinese operatives in Djibouti against American aircraft in that area. What did you make of that, Gordon?
Bill Gertz was referring to an incident in April of last year where China lasered a C-130, temporarily blinding two of the pilots. If the Chinese were trying to blind the pilots of a plane, then they were trying to bring down the plane. And if they're trying to bring down the plane, they're obviously trying to kill the crew. There should have been a more robust response on the part of the administration. And clearly the Pentagon should have been all over this in the military power report. So kudos to Bill Gertz for noticing that critical omission.
Yeah, well, I hope it will get remedied in at least the online editions, because it does seem to be a mistake. And we certainly don't want to be signaling to the Chinese that we're indifferent to such behavior. Let me ask you, Gordon, you have been, of course, tracking closely what's been going on in North Korea. You've written two books on the subject, as I mentioned, Nuclear Showdown and Losing South Korea. What is your current reading of the actions that the Korean regime under Kim Jong-un in the North is engaged in at the moment? Projectiles were being told they are. He's been firing off, some of which he's been personally overseeing the exercise of.
The Kim family right now seems to be putting pressure on President Trump. Obviously, they want relief from sanctions. So it is directed against us. This is not a militarily significant event or the one last April. But nonetheless, this is a political issue. It's also a political issue directed against Moon Jae-in of South Korea. Moon, although he's very pro-North Korean, does run a democracy, so he can't do all that he wants. And Kim Jong-un is frustrated that Moon is not giving him all that he wants. So this is a message to both Seoul and Washington. And we got to remember that Kim Jong-un is starting a new cycle of escalation. And this could get ugly very fast, because the North Korean rulers have often used violence to upset status quos that they found to be unacceptable. We could be at the beginning of that series of escalation.
We should, again, be alive to that distinct possibility, Gordon. And I'm assuming that the president and his team are. But again, you'll be watching this closely for us, among others. Let me ask you finally about Taiwan, Gordon. The French sent a destroyer through the Taiwan Strait recently, and it set the Chinese off. We've done it a couple of times ourselves in recent months, but haven't in quite some time, I believe 11 years, sent a carrier battle group through that region. Are we, by so doing, signaling that the Chinese have successfully dissuaded us from putting carriers in those waters, lest they be attacked by the rather considerable capabilities the Chinese now have to engage in such kinds of warfare, as opposed to back the last time we did this sort of thing as a show of force. And what do you think it makes, it means to the Chinese and, for that matter, the Taiwanese that we're exercising this kind of restraint? Is it signaling that the way is clear now for the kind of amphibious invasion that China seems to have in mind?
The United States has really tried to back gingerly with regard to the Taiwan Strait. I think, though, we're going to see a carrier strike group go through the strait at some point, because China's been pushing Taiwan in ways which are just unacceptable. So I do think that we are reacting to China's more provocative and belligerent moves. But we should be doing this, as you point out, we should have been doing this a lot earlier. And the thing that I'm concerned about is that the ambiguous signaling that we have is convincing the Chinese that they can actually do something violent across the strait. So this is something we can prevent, and we can prevent it rather easily, as you point out. And I trust that the Trump administration is going to move in that direction fairly soon.
With respect to carriers in the strait, do you think, or more generally, you know, showing the solidarity with the people of Taiwan through arms sales or diplomatic missions or other engagement?
I think we're going to continue sending destroyers through the strait, but eventually we will get to a strike group. And we're seeing this right now, for instance, Frank, with the U.S. sending a strike group to Iran because there are threats against American interests there. And the Iranians have threatened to attack the U.S. And so, you know, we got a strike group on the way there now. And that's a good thing. And I think we're going to see the same tactics with regard to China in the Taiwan Strait.
Well, we'll be, as I say, Gordon, very much following this. This is a critical moment, obviously, in the relationship between the United States and China in a volatile part of the world, and at a moment that I think has the potential to go seriously sideways. So a powerful argument for the United States military to be equipped with the forces and ready to deal with these contingencies, as well as the other kinds of unrestricted warfare against which the Chinese are waging against us. My friend, that's the end of our time today. Thank you so much for visiting with us. As always, it's great to talk with you. We'll do so again next week. Next up, we will speak with Russ Dallin about developments in Venezuela from the publisher of the Latin American Herald Tribune, right after this.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Russ Dallin, the president and editor-in-chief at the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also the head of the international investment bank, Caracas Capital Markets. He has in the past served as the president of Venezuela's Daily Journal and has been closely monitoring developments there for quite some time. We are privileged to be able to pick his brains on occasion. And Russ, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
It's always great to be back with you, Secretary Gaffney. You cover these insurgencies like no one else does.
Well, that's nice of you to say. If so, it's thanks to you. Let's talk a little bit about the present problem. An insurgency, I guess, is one way of describing it. The constitutional president of the Venezuelan Republic is Juan Guaido. There is a lot of reporting here in the United States that he has essentially, you know, lost the struggle with Maduro, Nicolas Maduro, the outlaw, I guess one might say. but the man who is nonetheless continuing to enjoy at least the majority of support from the Venezuelan military. Where do you think things stand at the moment in terms of their struggle, and what might we be most usefully doing about it at the moment?
Well, you're absolutely right. The last week has seen a lot of movement, not so much results as perhaps both the U.S. administration and the leader of the opposition and interim government or interim president that we recognize, Juan Guaido, would have liked. On the day before May Day, shortly before 6 a.m., there was an announcement that the military had joined with Guaido, and he and another political prisoner who had been in jail for 3 years and had been under house arrest appeared and saying that they had been liberated and that they were joining with the military, and they showed up at a military base in Caracas. So the day started brightly. It turns out, according to American officials, that there were agreements with several of the high leaders, including the commander of the military, as well as the head of the intelligence services, the head of military counterintelligence, and the president of the Supreme Court, to have a peaceful transition, overthrow Maduro, and move away. But as the day passed, those people did not seem to honor their commitments, except for the president the head of the intelligence services, who quickly disappeared, appeared to be honoring his, and has been spirited out of the country. But the others did not. So this attempted peaceful coup, fell apart. And I imagine that President Maduro, or the Maduro regime, or Mr. Maduro himself, is probably sleeping with one eye opened, knowing that there's betrayal all around him in his ranks. But time is on his side as the Cuban agents ferret out who the bad people are. They're even giving lie detector tests to a lot of the military to see who is against him and who is not. So I imagine he's not sleeping very soundly.
Well, this raises a point that has been prime concern for some time, and that is the degree to which the Cubans, or for that matter, the Russians, the Iranians, the Chinese, these external powers are enabling Maduro to cling to power, propping him up, securing him physically, intimidating the opposition. Do you see any sign that, apart from this intelligence chief, whose departure I have to believe is a rather significant blow to the regime, that there's any likelihood that as long as that foreign support remains intact, there will be the kind of collapse of this regime that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo suggested yesterday was just a matter of time?
I do. The amazing thing is that Secretary Pompeo also said on Wednesday following this change of government attempt that Maduro was leaving the country on his way out until he got a call from Vladimir Putin, who told him to stay and not to leave. So they're on very shaky ground right now. The Cubans are very, very much there. There's 20 to 30,000 Cubans there in force, which makes it very difficult for the military to plot against them. They keep all the military, the material, the arms under lock and key with dedicated Cuban advisors there supervising it and all throughout the ranks.
So, Russ Dellen, when we hear the Cuban government's representative saying there are no Cuban troops on the ground, this is rubbish?
It's pure rubbish, yes. You could fertilize your lawn with it. And there are agreements in place. This is not there are public agreements in place, so the Cubans are there as doctors or sports advisors. And as a matter of fact, Venezuela pays for those Cuban advisors that are there with oil shipments. That even as Venezuela is falling apart and starving, they're still shipping oil to Cuba.
Right. To prop up the Cuban regime in turn. So we have these external forces, and I did want to ask you about Russia as well. You mentioned that Secretary Pompeo indicated Putin personally intervened to keep Maduro in country. There are reports that also in country are Russian troops, Russian missiles, and other capabilities that may pose a threat to this country, as well as conceivably to the people of Venezuela and its neighbors. What do we know about that? Specifically, I gather there's an interesting new report about one of the terrorist factions in Colombia and its lash up with the Russians as well.
Yes, well, the Russians became the arms provider to Venezuela, for profit, of course. There's nothing less for free, and sold them 92 T-72 tanks, 24 Sukhoi fighter jets, and most importantly, from the U.S. perspective, the A-300 or the A-3000 missile defense system, which they also have in Syria. And that has been most, you know, that is a concern if there was to be an intervention by surrounding forces, that is something they have to watch out to. And what the report that you're alluding to is that apparently the ELN, this terrorist faction in Colombia, which is also operating with impunity in Venezuela, has been trained by the Venezuelan military in the use of the heat-seeking surface-to-air missiles, these Russian, they're called ILGAs. They've been taught how to use them. We don't have any evidence that they've been provided them. They're not very expensive. On the black market, you can get them for less than $50,000. It's not inconceivable that they have them, but also defectors have also told us that the ELN, which operates throughout Venezuela, has to be a rear guard, basically, to keep Maduro in power and fight a battle if they need to.
Yeah. So there's a lot of moving parts here. It raises the question, do you think at the moment, at least Russ Dallin, that there is a credible possibility that the U.S. military may be both required and actually engaged in this kind of ultimate disposition of the case in Venezuela?
I think at the moment, the U.S. government policy is to try all ways of doing this without the use of American forces and American bloodshed and bringing us into for all of the reasons and problems that entails. But I believe that is held as an ultimate option if we need to. Indeed, the president, the interim president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, who we recognize as the president of Venezuela, has the option to call for the use of foreign troops and U.S. forces as part of his constitutional abilities. And indeed, there's also a 1947 Rio Pact, which allows us, if there is an attack on one of much like NATO, if there's an attack on one, that the Rio Pact countries would come to the aid of the country that is attacked, in this case being Venezuela. So there are several different legal ways that the U.S. might be called upon to assist in this transformation.
This is a matter that is of great concern to all of us, I think, and it's most appreciated for taking some time, Russ Dallin, to walk us through what the stakes are and what the latest developments are. We appreciate the work you do at the Latin American Herald Tribune, and come back to us again with updates in the very near future, if you would. We hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.